Thank you very much. It's an honor to be here and be the first speaker. That means you're all still asleep and you can forget about things that I say. I am a postdoctoral fellow at the University of Texas, NSF postdoctoral fellow. I'll be looking for jobs the next couple years. So if you like what I had to say, please remember me. And if you don't like what I had to say, please feel free to get a collective amnesia. The work I'm going to talk about today is on the initial final mass relation of white dwarfs as derived from observations of white dwarfs in open star clusters. And there are many people who've helped contribute to this work. I especially want to highlight Jim Liebert, who taught me a lot about white dwarfs that I didn't know prior to being at Arizona. And I also need to thank Detlev Kester, Matt Wood, Pierre Bergeron, and Gilles Fontaine for giving me freely a lot of their white dwarf evolutionary models that figure heavily into the observations that I'm doing. So the initial final mass relation, in case you know that's a foreign term to you, it's the relationship between a star's zero-age main sequence mass and the mass of its white dwarf remnant. So you start off with a nice hot blue star that then, through some sort of process, loses the vast majority of its mass, and you end up with a white dwarf. This is a close-up view. We usually don't have that high of resolution. So why is knowing this relationship important? Well, you know, to talk about this conference here, this is a very often shown plot with many of the different types of potential type 1a progenitors. I don't want to go into detail on that because you'll quickly learn how shallow my knowledge is. But any of these channels that you want to follow or any new channels you want to propose, you need to do some sort of population synthesis. And one thing the initial final mass relationship does in that is if you want to go from, say, an initial mass function to a number of white dwarfs of a given mass, you need to include the initial final mass relation in that. Other things that the initial final mass relation is used for outside of these population synthesis, it's very important in studying the chemical evolution of galaxies. It also will tell us a little bit about type 2 supernova progenitors, as I hope to mention. So there are many ways that you can calculate the initial final mass relation from theory, and I have yet to see two that produce results in agreement. This is an old version presented by Weidemann, who was one of the first people to really push the initial final mass relation back in the late 70s, and he's continued on to this day working on it. And here you see several different theoretical models at the time of the core mass of an AGB star. So this is the final mass here, what would be your white dwarf mass. This is your initial stellar mass here on the bottom. And there were, you know, several different relations. And to this day, you go to people who are doing stellar models, say, I often use the Padova group's models, and you can find their core masses, what would become the white dwarf mass, at various stages along the AGB phase of the star's evolution, and you end up with a fairly discrepant initial final mass relation from that, depending on where in the AGB phase you stop the star's evolution and assume that mass loss occurs. So theoretically, this is a fairly intractable problem until we better understand mass loss. So rather than approach it theoretically, I intend to work on it from an empirical observational viewpoint. So there are many questions about the initial final mass relation that remain to this day, and I hope that I can answer a couple of these, but not all. First, is the initial final mass relation single-valued? For a four-solar mass star, do you always get the same mass of white dwarf? Or if you see a one-solar mass white dwarf, did it always come from the same initial mass of star, or is there a range in there? Is there significant internal scatter? That's sort of the second order perturbation on that first question. Of if you have a four-solar mass star that makes a 0.9 solar mass white dwarf, is it always exactly 0.9 solar masses, or is there some scatter, and what scatter is there? What is the effect of metallicity on the initial final mass relation? A priori, one might expect that metal-poor stars will produce more massive white dwarfs. And so I want to search for observational evidence of that. What is the maximum mass of white dwarf produced by single star evolution? Until recently, we didn't know of any open cluster white dwarfs that were more massive than one solar mass. Although, as I'll show you today, that has changed just in the last few months and by quite a bit. And finally, what's the maximum mass of white dwarf progenitor stars? And that gets into your core collapse supernova progenitors. What's the minimum mass for core collapse supernova progenitors? All of that we can answer with the initial final mass relation. How do I construct an empirical, or how does anyone construct an empirical initial final mass relation? Well, first we find white dwarfs by photometry, usually, in open star clusters, and we go and we obtain high signal-to-noise spectroscopy. We then use models of white dwarf atmospheres to determine the white dwarf's effective temperature and surface gravity. And then we add in white dwarf evolutionary models, which translate this effective temperature and surface gravity into the white dwarf's mass and its cooling age. And here's where the magic of having an open star cluster comes in, that we know the total age of the white dwarf plus its progenitor star. And that's the age of the star cluster, since all the stars are coeval. So we subtract the white dwarf's cooling age from the star cluster age, and that gives us the age of the progenitor star from the zero age main sequence until it entered the white dwarf cooling track. And so once we have this progenitor star lifetime, we use stellar evolutionary models from some theoretical calculations and calculate the progenitor star's mass. And so now we have done this for, various groups have done this for a total of actually 12 star clusters, although I only plot 11 here on this graph, ranging in age from the oldest being M67 at 4 billion years. These are points that I just got this last week. And you see that they make about 0.6 solar mass white dwarfs. And we range in initial mass all the way up to white dwarfs that come from 6 and 7 solar mass stars in young clusters such as the Pleiades, NGC 2516, which is a southern hemisphere Pleiades age cluster, and M35, which is just a hair older than the Pleiades. The purple points are M35, and those are also very new points that I've just been able to calculate here in the last few weeks. And what you can see, and you also notice that, yes, I did put some points like yellow. There's a reason for that. I don't want to say that the people who did a great job, but the data were very poor signal to noise. So the error bars are actually very large here. And since they'll probably be watching this, I want to say that, you know, it's not their fault. But I also want to say that I don't include those yellow points or in any further calculations. I have included them, and they don't make a significant difference on any of the conclusions that I'm going to present. So let me move on. The largest uncertainty in the observational initial final mass relation are the ages of star clusters. And this is very well illustrated by looking at the purple points, M35. So in this plot, I assumed a best age of the star cluster of 200 million years. And what you notice is that these purple points, which form a very nice sequence on this diagram, seem to lie above several other star clusters, such as M34, which is solar metallicity, the red points, which are NGC 2516, which is also solar metallicity. M35 is lower metallicity. I'll come back to that point. But you see they seem to lie above. You say, aha, maybe we see something here. But the error on the age of M35 is really 200 million years plus or minus 100 million years. So let's go with a half sigma younger for the cluster at an age of 150 million years. And you see that those points which were lying above now lie more or less on a line. And as of now, we don't have better ages for these star clusters. And so we need to really work to get those ages down very accurately. Let me also say these error bars here are just pure observational errors on the white dwarf properties. They do not include errors in the age of the star cluster. No, I don't. For most of these star clusters, the error bars on the A's are sort of similar to the error bars here on the red points in this diagram. An uncertainty of about a solar mass in their initial mass. The error bars are smaller as you go to lower mass progenitors just because there a change of a lot in the lifetime is a very small change in the progenitor star mass. So one way to try and actually quantify the observational initial final mass relation, I just went into this previous diagram and bend things up in half solar mass bins by progenitor mass. And I didn't include any of the observational errors or any of the star cluster errors in this binning. So, you know, take this with a grain of salt and be careful using these values. But what you can see is that even by doing this binning, we get a fairly linear initial final mass relation with perhaps a kink down here at lower masses, which we kind of expect. When you look at the field white dwarf mass distribution, there are a lot at 0.6 solar masses, and those probably came from 1 to 2 solar mass stars. Whereas if you follow this trend linearly, you're down below a half solar mass for those progenitors. But by and large, it's fairly linear. You can do a least squares fitting, which I've done here. And just to give you an idea on the error bars here, if I change from the best cluster ages to that younger cluster age, as I showed on the previous plot, the slope goes from 0.12 to 0.08. So there's still about a 30 to 50% uncertainty in this slope, especially here at the high end. But as I said, whether or not I include the, I can exclude several of these points from lower signal-to-noise clusters, and that doesn't change these results very much. So this is the current linear fit. Also shown on this, and that's in blue, also shown on this plot are two other initial final mass relations in the literature. Weidemann's revised semi-empirical initial final mass relation from 2000, which is shown here as the long dashed red line. And then Lilia Ferrario and collaborators in 2005 created another initial final mass relation that's this wavy magenta line. That was done by inverting the field star mass distribution. So, and determining what initial masses you need to recreate what we see in white dwarf field star masses. So, and pretty much what you can see is that assuming that these star cluster ages that I've assumed are correct, these previous initial final mass relations tend to underestimate the white dwarf masses at coming from higher progenitor masses. Another thing you can notice is that you don't get, if let's say that you want to say that your type 1a progenitors require one solar mass white dwarfs to start out with and then accrete by some method, you notice that there you need about a 5 solar mass star before you start getting these very massive white dwarfs. So these very massive white dwarfs are rare. Now let me, hold on for a second here. We'll go ahead. Talk about the intrinsic scatter. This comes back to the question of, does a progenitor star of a given mass always produce a white dwarf of the same mass? What I have done here is taken the stated observational errors in the white dwarf mass from various papers that have done this initial final mass relation, and then compared the scatter in my binned distribution about the mean within each bin, and calculated how much additional scatter do I need above the stated observational error to reproduce the observed scatter. And I did that as a function of initial mass. Once you get out to the higher masses, there just aren't enough points out here yet to really do much. But what you see is that we do need some additional scatter above the stated observational error of about 0.05 to 0.1 solar masses. And I honestly don't know whether this additional scatter is just underestimates of the observational errors. I suspect that that's probably a significant fraction of it, because some of the stated observational errors, including my own, seem ridiculously small on the derived white dwarf mass. But this could indicate that there is some intrinsic scatter on the order of less than a tenth of a solar mass, but certainly not larger than that. And coming back to this idea of whether there's a metallicity dependence or not, again, we can look at M35, which is definitely subsolar. We can look at this NGC 2516 or Praesepe, which are solar metallicities. And you notice that the M35 points do appear to create slightly higher mass white dwarfs, although, as I said, within the errors in the age of the star cluster, that's insignificant. So I don't want to make much there, but to say that if we can beat these errors on the star cluster age down, we can start to explore this metallicity dependence. Also, if you look at the sort of in the lower region here, around 3 to 4 solar masses, we have two star clusters, NGC 6633, which is slightly subsolar, and Praesepe and the Hyades, which are clearly supersolar, and the red and the blue points here overlap. There aren't a lot of points there, but at least within the observational errors, it looks like at sort of 3 to 4 solar mass stars, there's no significant dependence on metallicity. Let me also point out at this time, these highest mass white dwarfs, which have all been sort of announced in the last few years. There's a green point here, last few months. There's a green point up here at 1.3 solar masses, an initial mass that is greater than 6 solar masses. We don't have a very firm limit on it. That's GD50, which was found by Paul Dobby and collaborators to be likely a member or a former member of the Pleiades star cluster, or at least the Pleiades star cluster forming event. I also found two 1.2 solar mass white dwarfs in M35, one of which has a fairly firm initial mass. The other one is just a lower limit. The reason for the lower limit is that within the errors, the white dwarf is the same age as the star cluster. So we are finding 1.2 to 1.3 solar mass white dwarfs in star clusters. If you had asked me 6 months ago, I said there aren't any, and maybe single stars can't make that massive of a white dwarf. But given how young these white dwarfs are, there really hasn't been a lot of time for any merger events. So these may well be progeny of single stars. And just one completely aside, but I wanted to mention this because I'm trying to get telescope time to follow this up. But in one of our star clusters, we have, in the star cluster NGC 6633, we have found two white dwarfs that are consistent with cluster memberships, except that they're exactly 0.75 magnitudes overluminous for cluster members. And that's extremely suspicious of these being double degenerates. Their masses, so they're these two objects here, these two open squares, and if they were in the star cluster, they should be about where this large dark filled circle is. So they're overluminous by 0.75 mags, and their masses from fitting spectroscopy are 0.8 solar masses. Now, it's been shown that when you do these spectroscopic fits, that the mass that you get for a composite spectrum is sort of an intermediate mass of two components of that. So I think that there's a very good possibility that these are double degenerates, and if they are double degenerates, that they're significantly their combined mass is significantly over the Chandrasekhar mass. However, I have no spectroscopic proof first that they are double degenerates, and further, absolutely no clue what sort of orbital parameters these may have. So we do have time to at least address if they are double degenerates in the coming telescope cycle, so be able to tell you more on that in the future, hopefully. So if I'll just summarize with our conclusions, white dwarfs are ideal tools for creating this open cluster white dwarfs are ideal tools for creating an observational initial final mass relation. The initial final mass relation that we find empirically is fairly consistent with a linear relation, a one-to-one correlation, but there could be some intrinsic scatter on the order of up to 0.1 solar masses, but the intrinsic scatter could also be significantly less than that, depending on systematics errors that have not been well quantified. And the dominant error in the existing initial final mass relation is the age of star clusters, which we need to pin these ages down much more accurately, and several people and I are working on trying to do that. And there may be metallicity effects, but because of this large uncertainty in the cluster ages, we can't really say whether or not the metallicity of the progenitor star affects the white dwarf mass. So I'll stop there. Thank you. Ah, yes.
I was just wondering if you were going on.
Since you remind me, yes, I will. And part of the problem comes, again, back to the cluster ages, but if we just look at the initial final mass relation here, you notice that with the exception of this M35 white dwarf, which is a lower limit, and a 2 sigma lower limit, we don't see any white dwarfs with progenitor masses that are clearly above 7 solar masses. And again, these points here, they can move around quite a bit depending on the cluster age. If we can narrow this cluster age down better, with much more precision, we probably can start to put very strict limits on this core collapse. But it's looking like the answer would be somewhere between 7 and 8 solar masses. I'm also talking with a postdoc at Texas, Justin Mond, who's working on locating core collapse supernova progenitors in archival images of external galaxies. And he's also finding a sort of a upper limit to this core collapse supernova of somewhere around less than 10 solar masses. So we're starting to narrow this range down, I would say somewhere between 7 and probably 9 solar masses. And again, as we get more accurate ages, more precise ages, we should be able to narrow that down. But it's something that you can almost read off the graph.
Can you tell me one of the things you want to do in the studies, if it's possible, is the same set of theoretical calculations for all of the cluster isochrones, and the same thing is possible for the light log two.
That's a good point. So the question is, we definitely want to make sure when we're comparing these that that we're comparing ages for the clusters, we're comparing white dwarf models that are all from consistent literature. And what I have tried to do in assigning open cluster ages for this diagram is select ages that were chosen from either the same set of theoretical isochrones, or if not, at least make sure that we're using all overshooting models of spectroscopic metallicity. And so that's a slight concern, but I don't think the differences in this plot from that are that concerning to me right now. The other issue about the white dwarf cooling models is that other than the spectroscopic models, which for these temperatures of white dwarfs, everybody's spectroscopic models agree, but then I just take their to create this plot, I've taken their published effective temperatures and surface gravities and gone through the calculation with a single set of white dwarf evolutionary models to make sure that they're all consistent in that regard. So I am trying to pay attention to that. Yes.
I'm not sure whether it's actually quite that much, because we know that it ends in the cupola. And cupola, they do have these
Okay.
And you get such a right walking distribution, it's very similar to a shear form. And you need to find a mass relation to a reflection.
Super. That's good news to me. That's
okay.
I just wanted to ask you a little bit about the selection effect. Because it seems that if you really understand that, we can go back to the initial mass distribution, for example, or maybe some other interesting things in terms of putting limits on the numbers of representatives. So is that well understood?
The selection effects within individual clusters have not been well characterized by the various groups that have done this, including my own. I have a feeling that in M35, for example, we are fairly complete in finding white dwarfs and in following them up spectroscopically. But in a lot of other clusters, it's uncertain. For example, Praesepe, it's recently been shown by Paul Dabi and his collaborators that there are several white dwarfs at a much larger radius than had previously been examined. And so that's a concern for all of these. So I don't want to state that any of these individual clusters are complete. And that, as you say, there are things that you could do if we could be sure that these are complete samples, but they're not. That's true. I have no information whether these highest mass white dwarfs are carbon oxygen or oxygen neon. I have gone through and replaced this diagram assumes carbon oxygen. I have gone through and replaced carbon-oxygen models, white dwarf evolutionary models, with some new oxygen-neon evolutionary models from Althaus and collaborators. And it does have an effect. It tends to make the white dwarf slightly younger. But the difference is on the order of less than half a solar mass in the progenitor mass, which, again, in light of the uncertainty in the cluster ages is insignificant. But it's something that I'm concerned about. Yeah. But I'm not quite sure how we can determine that observationally at the moment. The changing the cluster age does change the slope. I can go back and show that. So let's look at M35, which is the subsolar cluster. And here it appears to have essentially the same slope as the rest of the high-end initial final mass relation, though the points are very sparsely populated. And if we go to a younger age, the slope becomes much shallower. And so I think that that's certainly a question that can be addressed if you can narrow this down, these ages down.
Okay, so if the ages for the Pleiades in 2516 were sort of confirmed by doing this lithium dating of low mass stars as they're pushing them in sequence, is this something that you can do in M35? And sort of in the absence of that, you're stuck.
Yeah, it's a proposal that I'm working on to try and locate brown dwarfs in the cluster to do some sort of lithium dating. And M35 is at a fairly large distance. It's at about a distance modulus of 10. So the brown dwarfs, where you can do lithium dating, they're just on the hairy edge of being visible, but with current telescopes, they are visible to do the necessary spectroscopy. It's just a matter of getting the time to do that.